Hello, everyone. It's Sunday, and that must mean that there's another episode of this podcast dropping today. Right now, I'm still in Arkansas, in Eureka Springs to be exact, and it is so beautiful and so glorious. I just wish every single one of you could come here and visit with me, share a coffee, have a little conversation, and talk about how amazing this world is. I need to thank everyone for the ratings and reviews that you've given me. I have over 100 five-star reviews now on both Apple and Spotify. But guess what? Guess what? I'm asking for more. If you're a new listener or a longtime listener and you feel like spreading a little bit of your own magic in the world, be sure to go to one of those platforms and give me a rating or write a sweet little review. I need to also thank all my Patreon supporters. Without you, I wouldn't be able to do this podcast. Remember, listeners, every little bit helps. Whether you pledge $3, $5, or $10 a month, whatever your donation is, please know that it helps so very much. This week, I have a super fun guest. I know I say that every week, but this week, Harry Werksman. How I adore this human being. He is an accomplished writer in Hollywood, a screenwriter, and the story of his discovery by one of the leading producers in Hollywood kind of had my jaw dropping the entire time. But he's many other things as well, as we all are. He describes a little bit of it in this podcast. He also teaches kids here in Santa Fe to become better writers. He's really out in the community. He wants to spread a little bit of his magic out there. And Harry is no stranger to miracles. He shares three of them in this episode. And I think you'll enjoy our conversation. I know I did. So now, without further ado, episode 116 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
I'm in there. My dog, because he gets up with me when you get up in the night, he comes trotting in with me into the bathroom because I'm like, they like to come in the bathroom and see what you're doing, especially at 4 a.m. And as I'm going to the bathroom, and I remember looking down at my watch for whatever reason, and it was literally 4:01, and I felt something in the bathroom with me, a presence. And my mother had passed away a few months. She passed away in March, and this was October. It's 4:01, my birthday. My mother has just passed away. I'm going to the bathroom. I feel something. The dog bolts from the bathroom. You know, I tend to not lead with what I do or what I've done, because I think while it's important, it isn't me. It doesn't define me. I don't think it should define individuals. I really introduce myself as, I guess if I had to choose, and I'm boiling it down, a student. I'm just a student. And, you know, they're like, oh, are you going to school? It's like, that's not what it means to me. Being a student, it exists in a far broader context that, you know, I don't believe we should ever stop learning. I don't believe we should ever stop growing. And so, you know, we are never too old to be students of ourselves. So that, I guess that. And then they're like, well, what do you do? And then I get into, well, I'm a writer, and, you know, and it was a circuitous path to get there, and, you know, was very blessed and very lucky with the career that I had. But, you know, I'm like, I was trying to learn all along. I mean, one of my favorite quotes of all time is, it was Nelson Mandela, who said, I never lose. I either win or I learn. I left Los Angeles and came to Santa Fe and found all kinds of amazing people like you and all kinds of amazing things that I'm giving my time to and my skills, but it's because I'm learning the whole time. I mean, I'm a student. I'm like, this is a different part of the world that I don't know. And now how can I be additive to it? And I think the other important thing being a student is, if you don't know the stories that came before you, wherever you are, if you don't know the stories that came before you, then how do you know where your story fits into the stream as it goes forward?
So one of the things that I'd love to talk to you about, you mentioned that your route to writing for TV was circuitous.
Yeah.
Was that something that you wanted to do since you were a child? Was it a passion or did it come later in life?
Writing? No, I've had it all the time. It was, you know, there's the sadness when you lose a parent, and then there's the actual kind of joy and beauty in the aftermath. You're dealing with the pain, you're dealing with the loss, but then you find things. You find things out about your, you know, in this case, it was my mother. And, you know, you start having to go through everything. I mean, when my mother passed away, my brother and I had to clean out the house we grew up in because none of us were going to move there. And, you know, my father was gone anyway. So, you know, cleaning out boxes and boxes of stuff. And my mother had saved. And I was like, oh, my God, I remember this from fourth grade. I went to this little tiny school called the Palm Valley School, and we had about 110 kids for K through nine, teeny tiny little school. And so there was a sort of school magazine that all the grades contributed to of one way or another. And I found a story that I had written that got published. It was like two paragraphs and it was called My Watch. And it was about a talking watch and who really thought it was funny when he discovered that the watch could burp. So I've always wanted to write. I've always been just reading. I loved books. I mean, I would get my allowance when I was a kid for doing chores, and I would buy comic books and sci-fi paperbacks. That's what I would do, and just read them as much as I could. My dad early on bought me all the Tom Swift books, you know, who's the teen, you know, the boy inventor, and he creates all kinds of great stuff, you know, the underwater atomic tracker. And I'm like, yes, I want to do that. So yeah, I mean, I always wanted to write, and it was always the arts, and then it was always history, because I'm like, wow, these are great, great stories. And so I sort of got into that, and I went in boarding school. My senior year, this other friend and I used to sit around. The boarding school I went to was Episcopalian, and we had to go to chapel, and we had to do, you know, you had to attend. You didn't have to go to chapel. They would allow you to go to whatever your service of choice was, and they'd arrange it for you. But, you know, when I was one of two Jews, and there was one Catholic, and that was kind of it, you know, you're like, yeah, we'll just go. It's just easier. But this friend of mine and I, my roommate, still one of my best friends, would sit around at night and just talk about life, the universe and everything, God, and what's it all about, you know, high school guys, right? And we ended up doing an independent study with Father Rogers, who is the priest at the school, called Does God Exist? And, you know, I sort of, and read all, you know, Father Rogers is great. He gave us all these books to read and really made me think about it. And that sort of started this. Now I'm interested in religion or spirit, and then eventually spirituality, but initially religion and history. Oh, and as a side point here, so I grew up in a Jewish household. I was bar mitzvahed. So when I was training for my bar mitzvah, the temple that I was at hired a new rabbi, this young guy. He was like in his mid-30s, which was a little radical at the time. And great guy, Bob Kaiser. And the first time I met with him, when we actually started studying, you read your Torah portion. And mine was God requesting that Abraham sacrifice his son. And so we read the passage and we finished, and I looked up at him and he looked at me and said, well, what do you think? And it blew my mind. I'm like, I'm not sure I understand the question. What do I think? He goes, yeah, what do you think is going on here? What do you think this means? And it was like, new world. because someone had asked a 12-year-old boy who, prior to this, in all his training, going to Sunday or Saturday school, here's what this means, right? This is what it means. End of story. And this guy asked me, what do you think? He was amazing. And I went through, I did my bar mitzvah. I was going to continue studying with him. And I'd made a promise to him that most people don't know, there is a confirmation in Judaism. You study until 16 and then you get, it's sort of, I guess, your advanced bar mitzvah degree. So I said to him, he goes, if I work with you, you have to promise to do this. And I said, I will. Like 6-7 months after my bar mitzvah, he was fired by the temple because it turned out that Bob was gay. And that was it. And I said, see you later, Judaism. If this is what's going on, I don't want any part of it. But I go to boarding school. I sort of rediscover an interest in, okay, why did Bob get fired? Where's all this coming from? End up, you know, going to Northwestern. I studied politics and history. And so I was writing all the time, writing essays and, you know, all this stuff. And then went to graduate school at Oxford. And when I got there, what I ended up studying was history and religion. And my thesis title was Religion, Politics, and Social Control in the County of Wiltshire, 1603 to 1625. Not a useful degree if you're going to leave academics as I did. Not useful at all. So I end up going to LA because I met a woman and we got married, and my first wife, she wanted to be in LA. I have this degree in 17th century English ecclesiastical history. I've left what I thought I was going to do, which was teach and write my entire life. Go to LA. I ended up working for a political consulting firm, Spin Doctors. It was horrifying and horrible. And when I quit, you know, my wife was like, well, what are you going to do? And I said, I really like to write. And, you know, off I went. I love TV. I love telling stories. And I'd never read a script in my life, ever. Never even seen one. Went to UCLA, learned anyway, and eventually broke into that. So I guess deep down the short answer is yes. I've always wanted to be a writer in some form or fashion, to tell stories in some form or fashion. And in everything that I've done, I think even with the horrible Spin Doctors, we were just telling a story.
I'm sure my listeners would love to know, you have done screenwriting. What are some of the shows you've worked on and what was your favorite?
So I've worked on many, many shows. The first professional sale I had was to Star Trek Deep Space Nine. The producer there, I'm going to give a shout out right now. Please keep this in, to Rene Echeverria. He was a producer on Star Trek. They had this policy that you could come in. Anyway, I pitched him an idea, and afterwards he goes, I love it. And I'm like, oh, thank God, I'm going to sell something. And he's like, but that is a 7th season show. We're in season 6. And I'm like, okay. And all Star Trek series go 7 seasons and then they're done. So I leave and I call a friend and like, how'd it go? And I'm like, yeah, they really loved an idea and they're going to steal it. And, 6 months later, his assistant called up and was like, we're buying your story. So anyway, shout out to Rene Echeverria. I worked on a bunch of shows. My early career was mostly sci-fi. I love sci-fi. I mean, I literally as a kid, I won a tiny little 13-inch black and white television because I was a Weeblo, which is a Boy Scout between, or a Cub Scout becomes a Weeblo, then a Boy Scout. So you spend this weird year. I did this weird year and we sold raffle tickets and I won a TV because I sold the most tickets. And I would wake up every night. My parents would be like, go to bed. I would wake up every night at 11 o'clock because Channel 13 in LA broadcast Star Trek, the original series. And I would wake up every night to watch it in the dark. So I love sci-fi. I wanted to be Captain Kirk, or at least a starship captain. And so working in sci-fi seemed like, well, this is what I'm going to do. And when I got to do it, I was like, yay. I ended up being in Australia for a year working on a show called Farscape. And I loved the show. I loved Australia. I came back to the United States, and my agents at the time said, listen, this whole sci-fi market, because it was all syndication and stuff like that, is really drying up. You need to do something. You got to pivot here. You got to make something different. So I loved living in Australia so much that I shamelessly wrote a pilot set in the outback of Australia. One of my favorite movies is Local Hero, which is about a guy who goes from an oil company, goes to buy a Scottish town because they have oil off there, falls in love with the town and saves the town. I love it. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to shamelessly rip this off. I'm going to set it in the outback of Australia, and I'm going to sell this pilot, and I'm going to come back to Australia and make my show. Well, I wrote the pilot. It was really good. ABC, it was the first pilot I ever sold. ABC sold it. I was partnered with Warren Littlefield as my producer. He was the head of NBC. When NBC came back, I was like, oh my God, this look how it didn't go anywhere. They didn't pick it up. They didn't want to shoot it. But what it did do was it got me an interview with Shonda Rhimes for Grey's Anatomy, which was the first season of Grey's. It hadn't even come out yet. They just shot the pilot. I was on there at the beginning, and she loved the pilot. And that changed my career. I pivoted. Suddenly I'm on Grey's Anatomy. We went from something no one had heard of to the number one show in the country. And we were like, holy crap, how did that happen? Amazing experience. Spent 4 years there. Shonda is a force to be reckoned with. I mean, I learned a lot from her just about being true to yourself and your vision and fighting for it. And things like blind casting. When you wrote a role, it was a medical show. So whether you were male or female oftentimes was important to the story that we were telling. But beyond that, it was best actor that we could find. We don't care age, race, anything, you know, blind casting. She's like, let's just pick the best people. That was a really, really important lesson. And, you know, she also, all the people have taught me is like, pick your battles. You're not going to win everything. And, you know, and also learned on that show, put in something that you know the network is not going to like so that they pick on that rather than the thing that you really are protecting. So Grey's and then, you know, and then it was luckily on, you know, network shows at that point, Ugly Betty, Castle, Moonlight, Little Vampire Show. I sold a bunch of pilots, but you asked my favorite shows. So there were two. I loved being on Grey's. It was a great experience. I learned so much. It was an interesting thing to be on the number one show. But my two favorites were, so I did a show between being in Australia and going on to Grey's Anatomy. It was called Veritas: The Quest. No one has really heard of it because it lasted three. We shot 13 and it lasted three episodes because no one understood it. The premise, which was fantastic, was Indiana Jones meets the X-Files, right? I'm being interviewed for this job, and I look at the guys who are interviewing me who created the show, the same guys who created Tomb Raider, or actually wrote all the Tomb Raider movies. So this was their TV show. And on the shelf was this book that I'd read numerous times called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which is, did Jesus have a child? It's sort of where the Da Vinci Code came from, all that. And I was like, hey, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, I've read that. And like, you've read that book? And I'm like, yes. So they're like, that's kind of where we got the show. So that was the kind of show it was. But clearly, so it was this jet setting archaeologist traveling around the world. We did shows about Da Vinci and Archimedes. And, you know, it was so much fun. So much fun. And shooting it was so much fun because we were building these exotic sets and doing all this stuff. And Nobody got it. And they canceled us. So I loved, loved, loved writing on that show because it spoke to me and what I was interested in. And then Moonlight, which was a little vampire show on CBS, lasted 18 episodes in our one season. Yeah, it was the first show that they gave me to run. I was the executive producer, showrunner, and I just loved doing it. We were on the wrong network. We were on CBS. You know, sandwiched between NCIS and CSI. I mean, who wants to watch it? And we were 1 year before True Blood came out. So anyway, Veritas and Moonlight. You know, everyone's like, not Grey's Anatomy. I'm like, yeah, I loved it, but not my favorite. I mean, not my favorite in creatively, I suppose.
You know, you've told me bits and pieces over the meetings we've had together, but this is the first time hearing the entire story. And I have to say that, you know, everybody's always talking about how challenging and difficult it is to get in as a writer in Hollywood. But not only that, like once you get into the writer's room, it can be like bloodthirsty in there. And it sounds like, honestly, yeah. I'm listening to your story and it sounds like you've had all these really incredible moments where you've been introduced to the right people or you meet the right people. You said Renee's name and I thought, oh my God, that's one of the biggest producers ever, because you have to know I love sci-fi. Yeah. Love it. Love it. Whenever I go into a bookstore, I go right to the sci-fi section. And so I've seen Renee's name forever watching all these shows over the years. And just the fact that that was who gave you this break, my jaw dropped.
About 2 weeks before I got the call that I'd sold this, I was also writing with my ex-wife at the time. We kind of looked at our finances because I'd been working with a friend who was an art director driving a prop truck, picking up props and taking them to set and unloading them. Doesn't really pay well. She was an assistant and we kind of looked at our finances and we were like, we kind of got like between 3 and 6 months left. And then we got to decide to do something else. And the universe was like, okay, don't go yet. Try this. And I actually have three, and I'll try and keep them brief. So the first one involves me in that it was my mother. So my mother was Scottish, born in Scotland, stern family, and she was a fashion model. And she was 18 and in Israel doing a swimsuit shoot for Janssen Swimwear. And so they are at the Sea of Galilee for this shoot, and they're staying in a hotel nearby. And my mother's story goes as follows. She was asleep. She woke up and felt compelled to go onto the balcony of her hotel room, which overlooked the Sea of Galilee. And she said, in that moment, I was paralyzed. I couldn't move. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't hear. Frozen. And she said, and then it ended. And she said, I knew that I had been in the presence of God, or that's how she described what she felt. The next day, the shoot moves to Jerusalem. They are walking through the old city and a rabbi comes up and grabs her arm and says, something happened to you. And would you like to talk about it? My mother says she went off to talk to this rabbi for like 3 hours. And he said, yes, you were in the presence of God. My mother, again, 18, Scottish, raised a Presbyterian, converts to Judaism. In England at the time, there was nothing other than Orthodox Judaism. So she went full bore. And, you know, I'd heard that story for a very long time. And on a trip to Israel, she took me back there, or all of us back there, and told me this story. You know, we didn't go to the hotel room, but we went to the hotel, which was still there. And she's like, right here, this is where it happened. And I was like, okay, that is, I don't know, Mom, you had a profoundly life-changing spiritual experience. Second one is for me. So that year I was in Australia working on Farscape, I took a trip on a train, which was unbelievable, from Sydney out to the center. I wanted to go see Uluru, Ayers Rock. And one of the things you can do is there's a trail that goes all the way around the base of Ayers Rock. It's like 8 miles or something like that. It's a big rock. And, you know, people are like, oh, did you climb it? And I'm like, if you go there and you talk to people, the indigenous population are like, it's like if you wanted to climb on top of St. Peter's Cathedral, you know, it's like, no, you don't do that. Anyway, so I decided to trek around the outside and, you know, there are water stations and it's marked so you don't get lost because you're in the outback. There ain't nothing around you. And I got onto the far side. And I stopped and I hadn't seen anybody. Not a lot of people do the whole trek around. And I hadn't seen anybody for like an hour. And there was nobody coming because you could see quite a distance because it's the outback. And I stopped and I'm drinking some water and I'm just staring out at the vastness of this land. I mean, it is just, it's indescribable. And it was silent, absolutely silent. I mean, unlike my mother, I could hear. And when I moved my feet, all I could hear was that. And then I realized I could hear my heart beating. I could hear my breath. And all of a sudden, I was like, I'm part of this. I am part of this. And I'm just staring at it. And all of a sudden, I realized I was weeping. I was just like, just not overwhelming emotion and connected. I was like, holy whatever. You know, I feel like that really, and being in the outback, I mean, you know, you can look at the stars and it's just unbelievable because you know, you can see the universe. And I watched, look at that. And I was like, oh my God, I'm part of that too. You know, and you get up early in the morning to watch the sun rise over Ayers Rock, Uluru, and you're like, and I'm part of that. And it was just so nurturing going out there. And I came back changed. I came back where I was like, right, right. And then the final one is kind of a funny one. So I was born at 4:01 in the morning, right? My mother tells me that 4:01 a.m. I came into the world. And on my birthday a couple of years ago, I got up, had to go to the bathroom. And I look at the clock and it's 4:00. It's 4 a.m. I'm like, okay, I'm in there. My dog, because he gets up with me when you get up in the night, he comes trotting in with me into the bathroom because I'm like, they like to come in the bathroom and see what you're doing, especially at 4:00 a.m. And as I'm going to the bathroom, and I remember looking down at my watch for whatever reason, and it was literally 4:01, and I felt something in the bathroom with me, a presence. And my mother had passed away a few months. She passed away in March, and this was October. It's 4:01, my birthday. My mother has just passed away. I'm going to the bathroom. I feel something. The dog bolts from the bathroom, like bolts, and jumps back in bed. And here's the kind of amusing part of it. I was so shocked and like, what is happening to me, that I farted. And seriously, I thought it was like a rocket blast where I was like, I must have lifted off the ground because it was just that physical react. Yeah, not many spiritual experiences come with a good fart story attached to them. And I like ran back to bed, you know, and I get in bed and you know, Amanda, my wife, turns and goes, you okay? And I'm like, I need to talk to you right now. I know it's 4 o'clock in the morning, but we really need to talk about this right now. I don't know. Was it a dream state that I was in and that had it? But so what? You know, that's the other thing I feel about these spiritual experience, stuff like that. People are like, oh, you know, like you said, your family's like, oh, that's not true. Whatever your experience is, it's yours. So I don't know. I could start parsing this experience and say, well, you were half asleep and the dog bolted because something else, you know, he's a dog and they just run away. I could probably explain it all away and have thought about all the other explanations. But I'm like, no, you know what? I choose to believe that in that moment, at the moment of my birth, I think it was my mom just being like, hey there.
That you have combined. We started off with a watch that burps.
Yes. Apparently I'm your scatophagy guest.
You're the guest that lays it all on the line. I love it.
Yeah. It's yeah. So, and I guess one of the other things I, now that we're down this path is, you know, you're asking in, or we were talking about what we were going to talk about and you know, spirituality and belief and stuff like that. So my dad, you know, Jewish, he was really culturally Jewish. My mother was far more Jewish. He could care less. He's like, really, we have to go to temple again? Didn't we just go? And she's like, yes, last week we went. It's now Friday again. Come on. So he really wasn't that into it. But, you know, he wore a chai around his neck. And one day he was getting something out of his wallet and a St. Christopher's medal fell out. And I pick it up and I'm like, what's this, Dad? So my dad's former business, he was retired at this point. His business partner was a guy named Danny Caselli, Italian, Catholic, second generation, you know, super. And he's like, Uncle Danny gave it to me. And I'm like, oh, I'm like, well, why do you carry it? And his answer, which I was like, awesome. He said, well, I don't want to get to the end of the race and find out I was back in the wrong team.
I think that's really interesting. But the other thing I was thinking that I think is so beautiful is, you know, if your mother would not have had, and I'm not diminishing, it just reminds me over and over again how there is this plan that's way bigger than we can even imagine or understand. If your mother would have not had that experience on the balcony overlooking the Sea of Galilee.
Yeah.
She would not have converted to Judaism. She would not have met your father and we wouldn't have you.
Yeah, and I know. It's remarkable.
It is remarkable.
Even begin to think about the gajillion things that had to happen to have you and I sitting here speaking to each other right now.
Yeah. I said to my friend this past weekend, I said, you know, I believe in the multiverse, absolutely. And all these bubble universes floating around that we can't see yet. But I said, I have a feeling in this universe, this is the one where everything works out. It all goes right. And she said, that's so beautiful. And I said, well, I mean, I hope that's the case, you know?
Right. And what's interesting to me about that thought, you know, I was talking about Stoicism. And of course, you know, there's all kinds of people, but probably the most well-known is Marcus Aurelius, because he was an emperor. And one of the things that what you just said reminded me of, he said, the world is dyed the color of our thoughts. And, you know, what you just said about you think this is the section of the multiverse in which it all works out. You're dyeing our little section of it here the color of your thoughts. And maybe it does all work out. You know, yeah, fingers crossed, right?
So much for listening to another episode of Bite-Sized Blessings. I hope you enjoyed the conversation I had with Harry. It's so fun to talk to someone who's doing what I eventually would love to do, but also someone who plays in the realms of spirit and magic. There's no doubt in my mind that Harry's surrounded by magic and miracles because he believes in them, because he believes that this universe contains them. And I think if we all believed like Harry, this world might be just a more magical place, a more beautiful place for everyone around us. I need to thank the creators of the music used in this episode: Frank Schroeder, Alexander Nakarada, Music L Files, Winnie the Moog, Sasha End, and Stephen O'Brien. For complete attribution, please see the Bite Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you'll find links to really cool music, to playlists, to artists, to lots of things that I hope lighten and brighten your day. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request: be like Harry. Believe in this bubble universe and believe that it is good. Believe that there's magic and miracles everywhere, in the people that you meet, in the food that you consume, how you go walking in your daily life, pretty much all of it. Believe in it, and then watch that magic and those miracles start happening all around you.